This is The Immigration Conversation, presented by Fragomen, a series of talks and discussions by leading immigration lawyers and professionals from around the world. We'll bring you the most up-to-date business immigration news, issues of concern, and strategies in the world of global immigration and mobility.
Welcome to The Immigration Conversation. And today's podcast is Fragomen's Private Client Practice series on global immigration options for individuals. And this is actually going to be the first in a series of events where we'll explore multiple immigration options for individuals who are interested in determining their own future. You know, a person's decision to emigrate from one country to another is commonly driven by a combination of factors, both personal and professional. And they can include the destination country's quality of healthcare and education, healthcare being particularly relevant in the current environment in which we're living, as well as personal and professional and business opportunities, quality of life, or simply protection and personal security and uncertainty. And the destination that suits one family may well not suit every other one. I touched upon the pandemic a minute ago, and perhaps one of the more positive outcomes of the pandemic is that it's opened our mind up to the possibility that we can live more flexible lives. Perhaps we don't need to live and work in the same place going forward. So if that is the case, what is this going to mean in terms of immigration options for us? So, you know, faced with all these challenges, the uncertainties of the world we're living in, as well as the opportunities that are currently being presented to us, people want to ensure that they can create the very best future for themselves and their families. And immigration plays a very important part in helping these individuals and families achieve their goals. So this podcast series will initially focus on immigration options into Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and the UK, all of which offer highly attractive opportunities for individuals, regardless of their motivation. But we'll also touch upon and expand our conversation and comments into any number of jurisdictions, particularly given that Fragomen's private client immigration practice advises individuals on immigration options across 170 countries. So for today's discussion, I am absolutely delighted to be joined by two of my colleagues. I'm Nadine Goldfoot, I'm managing partner for Fragomen in the UK. And I'm joined by two of my colleagues.
So thanks, Nadine. It's Teresa Liu. I'm the managing partner for Australia and New Zealand at Fragomen, and really looking forward to the conversation today.
And hi, everyone. Great to be here. My name is David Crawford. Despite my accent, I'm the partner responsible for Fragomen's operations in and practice in Canada. I live in Toronto, which is a city that's got more than 50% immigrants, and I'll be looking forward to telling you a little bit about the Canadian situation. And
thanks, both. Thanks, David. I said a couple of seconds ago that an immigration solution that suits one individual or one family may not be right for every other one, and that's absolutely correct. The right solution entirely depends on individual circumstances. But I'm curious that there must be some immigration trends we're seeing that we can identify from individuals' movements into our respective countries. So, I mean, Teresa, what are you seeing from Australia?
Thanks, Nadine. So for Australia, and I'd probably also include New Zealand into the mix, given our close proximity to each other. I think really over the course of 2020, the story is very similar between the two countries. And we have actually seen, some changes in trends for individuals. I think the first one is that there's been a really significant increase of inquiries from the US, particularly those seeking to invest or set up a business under, the relevant immigration programs that Australia and New Zealand have. And just as a bit of a statistic, in New Zealand in June of this year, there was a 160% increase of hits on the New Zealand immigration side. And that equates to something like, one hit every 30 seconds from a US user. And the story is similar in Australia, obviously. The other aspect, not as significant, is that we have also seen an increase in inquiries coming from the UK, Nadine. And again, looking at the website of hits on the New Zealand site, that there's actually a 72% increase in that. So, you know, a few destinations very interested in Australia and New Zealand. But I think from our perspective here, being so close to Asia, the proximity of Australia and New Zealand to Asia continues. There has been an increase in certain countries, including Hong Kong, some of that due to some Australian government changes in visa options and priority processing. But from an Asia perspective, that relationship's always been there from an immigration trend as well. So really interested to hear what's going on in the UK, though, Nadine, and what trends you're seeing there.
Thanks, Teresa. And I'm afraid to say I'm not unsurprised about the spike in interest from the UK. It's definitely a tumultuous time for us all. It's actually really interesting what you're saying about trends into Australia and New Zealand, because it's very similar for the UK. We're seeing, particularly over the last few months, a real spike in interest from the US. And that is, as you say, individuals are looking to establish businesses, entrepreneurs, innovators, but equally individuals who are looking to secure a solution from an immigration perspective, should they wish to exercise that in the future. We're not necessarily seeing people from the US looking to make moves at this point, but wanting to know that they have an option outside of the US for future planning purposes. And that expands the UK as well as Europe. We could talk a little bit more about Europe a bit later, but there are a number of solutions within the EU, which is highly attractive to US nationals. And then you've mentioned Asia as well, which is identical to what we're seeing, continued interest in Asia into the UK. That is driven very much about the interest in education being one of the UK's primary exports, big focus on families looking to educate their children in the UK, and also some changes to UK immigration legislation, which will enable students to continue their careers in the UK after they have completed their studies. So that's another big market. And then similar to Australia, we are beginning to see interest from Hong Kong, particularly given the UK's introduction of the visa category specifically for BNO passport holders. So David, given Australia and the interest into Australia and the UK and New Zealand do seem to be quite similar, what are you seeing in Canada? Does it differ considerably?
Thanks, Nadine. There are certainly some similarities. I think that the story in Canada is partly of change and partly of continuity, the continuity being that there's already a large immigration population, immigration intake of 340,000 people per year. And that's in a population of around 35, 36 million. So it's relatively large. That's likely to go up even further to 350 or 360,000 people. And so in that sense, the targets remain the same. And also a feature of the last 5 to 10 years has been an increasing number of students coming to Canada, and there are pathways for students who at the end of their courses to go through and ultimately qualify to stay permanently. So those things will remain in place. The commitment of the Canadian government to immigration has not changed. What some features of that did change was that quite a lot of people, very often those on work permits in the country, wanted to convert to permanent resident status once the pandemic came. And we've also seen an uptick like you and Teresa from certain parts of the world. They include Hong Kong, in our case also third country nationals, and more recently US nationals who are looking to come from America. That certainly has changed in our experience in the recent past, and that we're likely to see continuing interest from America, I would say. I think for the moment, though, Canada, I would add, has a system which, because the provinces get very heavily involved in process, there are something like 80 pathways to permanent resident status. And in other words, the country at a political level remains very committed to looking to all source countries to get the skilled immigrants that it's seeking. So similar to you guys, but some differences too.
Thanks, David. And, you know, it's interesting, we've all identified similar trends, albeit, as David said, some differences as well, but there are definitely some similar trends. So I'm keen to hear what you guys think in terms of what are the factors that are influencing these trends? What are influencing individuals' choices on destination? And I think particularly interesting in the moment is how much is COVID playing a part in that decision-making?
Thanks, Nadine. I might make a few comments about Canada to begin with, if it's okay. I think that the story in Canada is it is an immigration country, and the political messaging very much is that immigrants who qualify are welcome into this country. And it's not because Canada's being nice. There is a very real concern about the population aging, and that there are simply not enough younger people in this economy. So in the absence of immigration, there would be no growth and no continuing supply into the labour market. So it's very pragmatic. And at an entrepreneurial level, there are around about 40% of business owners, most of them baby boomers, who will be seeking to leave their businesses within the next 5 years. And that's a huge challenge for the country, as you can imagine. But I think, in addition to that, a country that's going to succeed in attracting the immigrants at once has to have categories where people are able to plan with relative confidence that they will qualify and ultimately get to move to that jurisdiction. That in going to another country, it's not simply a matter of qualifying, of course, but the outcomes meet the needs of the family and the professional needs of the adults in the family. And I think in both areas, Canada's done very well in providing support and the infrastructure that continues to attract people. I think, if anything, if you look back the last 20 years, I think that the number of destination countries has become more keenly focused, and we're certainly getting more inquiries from different parts of the world. And I think that COVID has sort of heightened these sensitivities, those two certainties that people are looking for, that certainty of qualifying and the certainty or confidence that there's a good life to be had in that destination. I see in the Canadian context that it's a good offering and a country that's got an appetite for immigrants to come in and contribute. I think it's part of the cultural fabric of this community. But what's your experience, Teresa? How does that compare with Australia?
Yeah, I mean, David, I think your comments are really similar to Australia. I mean, we're a country that is truly multinational, multicultural. 30% of Australians are born overseas, and it's often said that Australia was built on immigration, and the Australia's immigration program, although we have, you know, fairly strict travel bans in place, the government is still very much focused on attracting individuals into Australia, and they are particularly looking at the fact that from a COVID response and management point of view, that we have fared really well. And I think that's been really internationally recognised as well. And I think when we're dealing with inquiries and individuals as well, COVID in particular, and the way that Australia and New Zealand obviously have responded and managed the situation, both in first wave and unfortunately a second wave, I think that has gone a long way in terms of when I think about the factors influencing where an individual wants to go. It is the safety of Australia and New Zealand. But going back to this multicultural society, one of the other aspects I think that Australia has a long tradition of is having extremely strong ties with countries like the US and the UK. And again, we're really close to Asia as well. And really on that, in terms of that influence, some of that really leads to things such as, you know, ability to be able to, astronaut or commute internationally between countries so that there's a really mobile individual. And I think as part of the pandemic and the recovery from pandemic as well, this ability to astronaut will become more and more a feature. And I think the immigration programs will obviously need to adapt to what might be the, you know, the future of work, the future of living. I think that's something that, I think at least the Australian government is particularly keeping its eye on as well. The other thing I just wanted to mention around Australia and its attraction, we obviously have a really strong healthcare system, but we also have a world-class education system. And it's one of our top five exports as well. So there's a significant amount of effort that's put into that particular kind of service. So we do have significant amounts of immigrants that come in, or students, I should say, that then lead to pathways towards, more permanent stays as well. Lifestyle has always been a feature in Australia. But I think in addition to that, Australia is also being seen as very much not just about lifestyle, safety and security, but we have a strong regulatory environment. And I think people legitimately also see Australia as a really strong commercial and business centre as well. And there are opportunities here in Australia. And I think lastly, David and Nadine, when I think about Asia, I think about countries such as China, lack of pollution, clean natural environment. I mean, just those basic elements are really important kind of decisions or influences, I think, in individuals that we come across.
Yeah, I mean, Teresa, I would agree with both of everything you've both said. Lifestyle, quality of life, healthcare at the moment is particularly important. You know, how countries have responded to COVID is going to be a big impact and important qualifying decision for people going forward. I think in the UK, we're in a slightly unique position because you've both spoken a lot about how Canada and Australia are very multicultural societies set up to be very welcoming for migrants. And in the case of Australia, built on migrant populations. The UK is in a very interesting position at the moment because we have left the EU. The transition period ends on the 31st of December, at which point freedom of movement will end. And part of the messaging around the ending of freedom of movement and the UK's leaving of the EU is to try and better control and open up our borders to migrants more around the world, and not only to having preferential systems in place for EU nationals. So I think you could probably say on that basis that the UK is trying to open up and be more multicultural and not limiting the majority of migration from the EU. I think the one piece I would add on one of the key influencing factors for individuals who are looking at migration options is physical presence. When we talk about immigration, it does bring up the image of somebody or a family who are looking to, sever relations or ties in their home country and start a brand new life elsewhere. But we know in this current world we live in, it's not that simplistic. Immigration can mean many things. It can mean that scenario where you're making a wholesale family move. But equally, it could mean that you're looking to create footholds in other jurisdictions around the world in order to protect against uncertainty. So what we're seeing a lot of is families who are wanting to create that foothold. We spoke about the Americans early on, but continue to have their primary residence in their home countries or elsewhere. So in those situations, physical time that's required to spend in a jurisdiction in order to secure or maintain the immigration status could become very important. And I think that the UK is perhaps not always the best option, and rather some of the European countries do provide better solutions in that they require less physical presence than the UK. And then perhaps Canada and Australia do as well. So that's something to bear in mind. But we've all spoken a lot about what is influencing individuals, what countries at a macro level are doing in order to create environments for migration. But on a more micro level, what are we seeing from a government perspective in terms of immigration categories? Are they actually actively encouraging certain types of migrations through particular categories? David, you mentioned how Canada's always historically been very welcoming to migrants. What are you seeing at the moment from a government perspective in terms of immigration categories?
There are a couple of different threads to that. Bearing in mind that professionals from all sorts of walks of life are welcome, we have seen, in particular, two areas of change. The first is that people with specialist IT skills have been able to enter Canada more readily over the last few years, ever since what's called the global skill stream was introduced. And that facilitated the employment, people who were employees working for IT companies, so much so that the growth was extraordinary. And many of those people have converted to permanent resident status, because it's relatively straightforward for somebody who's gained at least 12 months work experience in Canada to qualify to remain permanently. That's had a significant impact, not only for the immigrants themselves. I think that it's assisted business to invest with more confidence in Canada, and it's generally been boon for both the individuals and businesses, and I'd say thirdly for the country. Another area of increased effort is from the provinces, who are keen, as I intimated earlier, to attract entrepreneurs who will hopefully buy many of those businesses that will be coming up to sale to maintain the employment opportunities that currently are available and to grow those businesses. And there's effectively competition between the provinces to get the people in who can do so. I suppose the third area I might mention as I think about it is what Teresa spoke about and I referenced earlier, and that is students who come in to study at university typically, who then qualify for a postgraduate work permit, and then with the work experience can stay permanently. They are clearly all in skilled occupations. Very often they're tending to be people in STEM-type jobs, and that's, I suppose, going to be a longer-term priority for Canada, as it probably is in Australia. And if you think about it, that means that a whole lot of young people, just as they begin their professional lives, start in Canada where they've been, despite the fact they've been born and educated initially elsewhere. So I think they're probably the common elements of what is happening now and will continue to happen.
I think it's interesting what you're saying about students, and that does seem to be a real common theme for everybody, and a lot of international competition to attract international students into the respective countries. Similarly, in the UK, I mentioned previously as well, under the new immigration rules that are coming into force in January, there are going to be enhanced provisions for students to enable them to continue their professional careers in the UK on completion of their studies, which is not something that we've had in the UK for the past few years. And exactly that, it was intended to attract more international students and competes with the likes of Canada and Australia. I think beyond the student population, one of the other key areas is health and care sector, particularly given the change and the move away from freedom of movement for EU nationals in the UK. The UK government is very wants to ensure that they have sufficient access to care talent, and so have put in place some particular provisions for that. And then not dissimilar to Canada, entrepreneurs and innovators looking to attract individuals who are going to be coming to the UK, addressing market needs, setting up new and innovative businesses in the UK, not exclusively, but largely in the tech sectors. And I think the final point I'd make, we touched upon Hong Kong earlier, there is a special provision in place for BNO passport holders, given the close relationship between, and the historical relationship between the UK and Hong Kong. Teresa, what are you seeing from Canada and Australia?
Thanks, Nadine. I mean, I think just hearing both yourself, Nadine, and David about the attraction and who your countries are looking to attract. I think it is similar for Australia. I think right at the moment, Australia is looking at how to deal with the immediate pandemic and the recovery, but they certainly have their eye on the future and a recognition that there is very much a competition for global talent and investment and so on. So I think, first of all, just thinking about right now and the recovery phase, the government is looking at those that are critical to that recovery phase. So in health, construction, IT are probably the three main ones. And the government only a couple of weeks ago, in fact, announced a priority list for processing of those occupations. And in combination with what we've seen in terms of concessions and exemptions to the travel bans in and out of Australia, it is very much driven around what that recovery phase should look like and what are the current skill sets. Having said all that, they are very much actively looking at other pools of I'll call it talent. So, David, you mentioned the Global Talent Scheme. Again, only about a week ago or so, the Australian government launched a new task force called the Global Talent Task Force or something similar, which is really aimed at even furthering trying to identify high caliber and entrepreneurial people with cutting edge skills in growth sectors. It's a program that's been around since about November 2019, I should add. But again, they're really looking at what will drive innovation and creation of local employment, particularly in this environment. Investors, I think, Nadine, you spoke about that. That is very similar for Australia. They're looking at investors that will assist. And in September as well, lots of things have been happening in the month of September here in Australia. Visa holders of the 188 visa, which is essentially the investor visa category, the significant investor visa and business owner categories, they'll actually be automatically exempt from the travel ban. So very much looking at those individuals contributing to Australia earlier than later. Regional Australia is, again, really similar. So it's similar, David, to your provincial comments. So there are specific programs aimed at moving people into those areas. And finally, students. So they're really looking at building up that sector again. And the Federal Trade Minister actually announced, last couple of months, a pilot program of around 300 students to enter South Australia, just to really test whether return of international students nationally could be managed from a kind of health perspective. So that'll be a really interesting trial as well. So that's happening, I think, in Australia and that eye, again, I'd say, in terms of, attracting certain migrants.
Thanks, Teresa. And, I think we've spoken about trends, we've spoken about options for individuals, but, the big question for everybody is execution. For any of these strategies, how do we make it happen? Most critical is planning, which is absolutely everything. And from my perspective, I really would suggest when individuals are considering how to pursue any of these options, they have to factor and consider timing. It's really, really critical. How long will it take to get the required status? And then start working backwards. And when we talk about timing, we're not just talking about timing of visa processing. It's about the lead time in order to be ready to submit the visa application. And that could include a lot of preemptive steps. In a post-COVID world, we could be talking about health certificates. In a current environment, many countries will require police clearance certificates. There may be language tests involved. And all these factors have to be considered in the planning stage as well, particularly if there's a family of children, the start of school terms, and when the children are going to be able to commence their studies will have an impact as well. I think what's worth considering in some cases is the tax positions. We've spoken about immigration today, but equally individuals should be talking to tax advisors to make sure that they are aware of tax obligations in the countries that they are looking to secure immigration status into. And then, you know, I'd say real estate options can be an important one as well. So, you know, David, Teresa, do you think we've missed anything there? And there are other planning considerations individuals should make?
Just from my perspective, Nadine, I think that's actually a really great list. And when you're talking about kind of critical dates as well, or milestones, also just thinking about what is it your long-term, or, you know, an individual's long-term gain or outcome that they're kind of seeking. Because when you're looking again at Australia, for instance, many of the options are temporary or provisional to permanent. And there's a lot of criteria involved to move from a provisional to a permanent visa in some instances, how you keep your resident status as well. So in terms of your physical residence or your contribution to Australia in some way, and there's pretty prescriptive rules around that. And then how do you move to citizenship? Do you actually want citizenship anyway? But how do you move to that? And how long is all that going to take? So the other point, Nadine, I just wanted to mention, because you mentioned family members, is, you know, I think, you know, the definition of a of family that can be included, and particularly dependent children, can change jurisdiction by jurisdiction. And the rules around that as well. So kind of that whole, which really goes to that whole family planning aspect, is do you want your older children to come out with you and migrate? Do you want your parents as well, your brother or sister? And really looking at that whole planning aspect in a really strategic way is, you know, really important.
I've got some similar thoughts. I agree with everything you guys have said. I think that all of those are important. What I'm seeing, what I think is prudent, is that people are not rushing decision making. They're looking what's the sensible thing to do, taking into consideration all the issues that you just mentioned, Teresa. And I think it's right. And I don't think necessarily one jurisdiction will be perfect for everything. Great if it is, but there'll be professional ambitions, and there'll be business type issues, and there'll be personal family type issues. And what, in the scheme of things, makes the best sense for a person's family will need to weigh all those considerations. Something that I think you guys have touched on also is, it's, while it's important to focus on criteria for a particular visa or work permit, the really, really important thing is to look beyond an immigration process at what the long term holds for a person and their family. And very often in a conversation about migration, I don't start a conversation about immigration criteria or rules. I ask people, what do they want to do in life? And then we can work back from there, as you were saying, Nadine. But I think that another feature of the present environment, and I think it's relevant for all of the countries that we live in, that we work in, is that immigrants are increasingly looking at the values of the country, the destination country. Is it a place that respects rule of law, personal liberty balanced with shared obligation, and a sound commitment to the children who will become the adults of the future? And I think that that's a very important starting point for many people. And these days, I think it's a very good starting point. Back to you, Nadine.
I think, I completely concur with everything you've all said, or hugely relevant and important factors. I think it's been a great discussion, and I want to thank you both for the involvement. Hopefully we've left everybody with some good food for thought in terms of considerations that they would make for any future immigration discussions. Hope to speak to you all soon. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks, guys. Bye now.
Thank you.
The Immigration Conversation podcast is presented by Fragment, the leading firm dedicated exclusively to immigration services worldwide. This episode is current as of the date of recording. With frequent changes in global immigration, be sure to keep up to date by visiting our website at www.fragaman.com and subscribing to The Immigration Conversation on your favorite podcast service to hear the latest episode. This podcast is for informational purposes only. This podcast does not constitute legal advice or give rise to an attorney-client relationship between any listener and our firm. If you have any questions, please contact the global immigration professional with whom you work at Fragaman.